This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Last Friday, the North Carolina Supreme Court banned the state from reimposing the death sentence on a black man named Marcus Robinson. He was removed from death row in 2012 after the courts determined his trial was influenced by racial discrimination in the jury. At the trial, the prosecution removed half of all the qualified black jurors, but only 15% of white jurors. Racial discrimination in jury selection can harm both defendants and excluded jurors. Lawyers are still seeking out solutions. Emily Coward is a project attorney for the Racial Equity Network Project at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Government, and she recently presented to Governor Roy Cooper's Task Force for Racial Equity in Criminal Justice on bias in jury selection. Emily, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to dive more deeply into racial discrimination and jury selection in a minute, but I want to start by stepping back a little bit and talking about jury duty more generally. It is something that many of us dread, that letter in the mail saying we have to do jury duty, but you argue that making sure everyone has equal access is really, really important. So tell me about why.
Sure. Well, the jury system was conceived as a fundamental safeguard of liberty and an essential aspect of citizenship. So the idea is that through being a juror, an actual or potential juror, we as the people have an ability to exercise a democratic check on the power of the state in the same way that through the ballot box, the people are able to express their political voice. The jury is really the voice of the people in matters of justice. And as Justice Kennedy said, juries are the tangible implementation of the principle that the law comes from the people. So despite how much we might dread getting that jury summons in the mail, the juries really perform a critical function.
Despite that, our jury pools often do not reflect the communities that they are a part of. So I'd love to talk about how that happens and why that is. And maybe you can start with the selection process for juries in North Carolina. How do we pick our juries and how do people get included or left out?
Sure. So, I mean, I think when people think about jury service, they're picturing what they might have seen if they showed up after receiving a summons in the mail. But there's a whole process that takes place, an invisible process that takes place behind the scenes to get to the point where those summonses are sent out. And in North Carolina, as in many states, actually, the list for that ultimately comprise the master jury list for the counties are from the DMV, from the list of registered drivers, and from the Board of Elections, the list of registered voters. So in North Carolina, if you are neither a voter nor a driver, you don't have any possibility of ending up on a master jury list. Those are the source lists that are used at the state level. Now, counties can, by statute, add source lists that they deem reliable, the jury commissions for each county, but in practice, I'm not aware of any that do. So that's kind of the background stage, the invisible stage of how our jury lists are formed. That's a very condensed version. And then there's a whole selection process that happens in the courtroom that the judges and the attorneys are involved in. So I can speak a little bit about that too.
Yeah, take me into that.
Okay, so once you arrive, there's a random selection process for determining who receives the summons. You arrive for jury service. There's a process through if you're trying to get an excusal or a deferral, you can go through that process. And then at some point through another random process, folks are asked to enter a courtroom so that they can participate in jury selection. And at that point, lawyers ask a bunch of questions to determine if they think that the potential jurors are appropriate for that case. And then they can either exercise challenges for cause, where they argue to the judge that this juror is not fit to serve. Maybe they have a connection to a witness in the case or otherwise seem to be someone that would not be impartial in the case. And they also have what's called peremptory challenges, or peremptory strikes, they're sometimes referred to as, where they can cut a juror for really any reason at all, as long as it's not discrimination on the base of race, ethnicity, or gender. And so in a capital case in North Carolina and a death penalty case, each side has 14 peremptory strikes that they can use. And in other criminal cases, you have six. Each side has six peremptory strikes.
Okay. So we know from the data, though, that black jury pool members are removed from a jury at 2 to 3 times the rate of their white counterparts in North Carolina. So talk about this and how that fits into this conversation of peremptory strikes? Because I know you are not allowed to strike someone purely because of the based on the basis of race, but we know that these statistics are still true. So how do you make sense of those two things?
Right. Well, ever since 1880, a Supreme Court case in 1880, it's been the law in our country that it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause to strike someone on the basis of their race. But that's been very difficult to enforce. And as of 1986, the legal mechanism by which courts have attempted to enforce that ban on race discrimination and jury selection has been referred to as the Batson framework from a case called Batson versus Kentucky. And essentially, a Batson challenge is when, let's say, the defense attorney believes that the prosecutor is striking someone on the basis of race. And so they tell the judge, Your Honor, I'd like to challenge that strike. And then there's a three-step test by which the court tries to determine if the strike was motivated by discriminatory purposes. The problem is it has proved, and, you know, Justice Thurgood Marshall, when Batson was decided, he was on the Supreme Court, and he sort of foreshadowed the difficulties in enforcing Batson, because he said that, you know, trying to understand what's going on in a prosecutor's mind when they are making a strike is an almost impossible task. And he essentially predicted that the Batson framework was going to fail. And in North Carolina, actually, in 34 years since Batson was decided, we have never had an appellate court hold that there was discrimination against a juror of color. At the same time, beginning in the late 1980s, we started seeing studies in North Carolina of the use of peremptory strikes by prosecutors in North Carolina. And when you combine all these studies, they examine 40,000 peremptory strikes across the entire state across a 20-year period. And they reveal that prosecutors, on average, exclude Black qualified citizens from juries at about the rate of twice that of white jurors. So we have essentially a failed enforcement mechanism and an ongoing problem that really threatens the legitimacy and integrity of our justice system.
Right. And this has real consequences. I mean, we started the intro talking about the case of Marcus Robinson and how racial discrimination in the jury impacted how that trial went. We know that diverse juries do operate more fairly, deliberate more constructively. So there are lots of consequences for the entire justice system to have and reasons why we need to have a more diverse jury. So the North Carolina Supreme Court earlier this year gave lower courts some guidance about how to better assess claims of racial discrimination. So tell me about what they said and what's significant about them speaking up about this for the first time in a long time.
Right. Well, like I said, North Carolina is one of the only states in the country where we've never had a successful Batson claim. We've never seen a Batson claim succeed where there was an allegation of discrimination against a juror of color. But we do seem to be at a turning point in North Carolina with our court's approach to Batson. And the two cases that came out in May and June from the North Carolina Supreme Court, Hobbs and Bennett, the court was really stressing that we need to have a more robust enforcement of Batson in North Carolina. And so they were saying things like, you know, when a defendant puts the history of peremptory strikes, some of which we already discussed today, in front of the court, we really need to see the trial court, consider that history and explain in its ruling how it makes sense of those, you know, those patterns of racially disparate peremptory strikes. We need the court to engage in comparative juror analysis. So that what that means is comparing, you know, the characteristics of a, let's say, a white juror who was seated with a Black juror who is struck. And so we really need the court to kind of show its work and how it's evaluating this evidence and not just summarily reject Batson claims, which is what we've seen a lot in the past. So we do seem to be, even though in both of those cases, the court didn't actually rule that the defendant had succeeded on its Batson challenge, they sent them back to the trial court with instructions to consider the claims a lot more carefully. So we may be at a turning point where we see stronger Batson enforcement in North Carolina.
Are there other reforms that you suggest for the jury selection process that could influence this system in addition to the guidance that the Supreme Court has given down?
Well, there are a couple areas where we're seeing reforms elsewhere in the country, and I know there's a lot of interest in North Carolina in these reforms right now. So in Nebraska, for example, where they also use voter and driver lists, they did a lot of research into who that excluded and found that People of color were significantly underrepresented, even though the idea with adding, I mean, when driver's lists were added in North Carolina, the idea was that that would diversify the jury pool. But we don't actually know if we have representative jury pools. That's never really been studied in this era. So adding source lists that can create broader diversity and representation in who ends up on the jury list is one reform that has proved successful elsewhere in the country. There are also states that are working to strengthen the Batson standard by really removing the focus on proving intentional discrimination, but trying to capture strikes that are motivated by implicit bias. And so, you know, having the court look to would an objective observer who's aware of implicit bias and structural racism think this strike might have been motivated by race? And in that case, seat the juror so that we're really trying to eliminate the risk of discrimination rather than imposing this impossibly high standard where you have to show that the person who made the strike is discriminating intentionally and then lying about it to cover up, because the Batson standard also requires a demonstration that the reason that the person gave for making the strike was essentially pretextual and a cover up. So there's been some reforms in Washington State and Connecticut. They're looking at some reforms in California to try to broaden the Batson standard to kind of capture more of what we know about how racial discrimination or racialized outcomes actually happen, so that we're not just requiring some kind of smoking gun of a racist actor and a racist act, and tolerating these patterns of racial disparities and racialized juries.
All right, we're gonna have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. Sure. Emily Coward, Project Attorney for the Racial Equity Network Project at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Government.
Thank you so much.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.